This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the news has been filled with nothing but political gridlock in Washington. The lingering effects of the financial crisis, structural problems such as high unemployment, and the skill gap of our workforce, and of course, the problems in our educational system. Are America's best days behind us? Some and a lot think so. But not this new author. Joel Kurtzman joins me on the program. He's the author of Unleashing the Second American Century, Four Forces for Economic Dominance. Joe, your new book really struck me as almost a 180-degree change from your previous books, things you wrote before like The Decline and Crash of America's Economy, The Death of Money, Dancing Past the Recession, Eating Our Own Seed Corn. This seems like a radical departure from previous books. What brought about the new direction of optimism?
Absolutely, Jim, and thanks for inviting me on your show. I'm a big fan. My change of heart came from a deep dive into the statistics of the American economy, number one. Number two, we have so many new factors at work. We have a tremendous growth in energy right now. The United States is the number one oil producer in the world, ahead of Saudi Arabia, ahead of Russia. That is new and unprecedented that a country comes back from being the largest importer of oil in the world to being now an exporter. We also have tremendous resources of natural gas. And the one thing everybody seems to ignore is that the United States is still the most creative, innovative country in the world in many, many industries, not just computers, but biotech and many other industries.
You know, one remarkable stat I found in your book, Joe, that I wasn't aware of. You know, most people are aware that the U.S. economy represents about 20% of global GDP. You know, we make over 20% of the world's stuff. The remarkable fact is we just have 4.5% of the world's population. That in itself is impressive. But what is even more impressive, add in what American companies produce overseas, and that number rises somewhere to a figure of 30 to 40%. That's remarkable.
Yeah, that is also an ignored fact about the strength of the American economy. What's happened is that we have a tremendous core in the United States itself that is vibrant and growing now again. But we also have the economy that has spilled over because it's so big to Europe, Latin America, Asia, and so forth. So our companies are the dominant force in the world economy. And people seem to ignore that. I think that that's to the good. A lot of manufacturing is returning to the United States from Asia, not because of any reason except that moving some of those factories overseas turned out to be bad business decisions. It's more profitable to manufacture in the United States. So some of that 35 to 40% of the world's GDP will be moving back to the United States, and that's a very happy development, especially for our workforce. What people also forget is that we have a worker shortage. It's not that we have huge, high unemployment. Our unemployment is going down. We have areas where we have real shortages of workers, and that's something we have to address.
I want to stay on that topic because, you know, if you picked up the Wall Street Journal newspapers, headline news, the 80s and 90s, Joel, as you know, were much about offshoring. And what we're seeing now, I can't think of a week that goes by where some company, whether foreign or U.S., is announcing building a factory here, including Apple's new 2,000-employee factory in Phoenix, Arizona. So you talk about several factors that contribute to this next American century: creativity, energy, manufacturing prowess, And, of course, the strength of our capital markets. And this is something I try to emphasize on our program with the dollar bears. You know, if there's a problem, take a look at Europe, Japan. You see problems in the Middle East. There's trillions of dollars floating around the world. If you're going to invest that, I don't think people understand how wide and how big our capital markets are and what an advantage that affords the U.S.
Oh, it's a huge advantage. We have somewhere between $4.5 and $5 trillion in cash within the bank accounts of our largest companies. That's a massive amount of money. It's undeployed, and it's ready to be invested. When that starts happening and we start investing again in a big way in the United States, the way Apple is doing in Arizona, the way Tesla is now, we don't know in which state, but Tesla is going to be the world's largest battery manufacturer. When this happens in earnest, it will be transformative. We also have excess capital on deposit with the Fed, $1.5 trillion there. And the surprising factor is that household wealth has recovered. The American consumer is in the best shape with regard to debt in 35 years. And American savings rates are now returning to international levels. So the sad fact is that the Great Recession hurt a lot of people, but it also cleaned out the system. And that's what depressions, recessions tend to do. They clean out the system of debt. They set the stage for a renewed period of growth. This one has been tougher and has taken longer than in the past because the problems were worse. But those problems are largely eradicated now. So we've fixed a lot of the problems from the last 6 years of slow growth.
You know, you talk about transformative forces reshaping America in this new century. Soaring levels of creativity, massive new energy reserves, gigantic amounts of capital, and unrivaled manufacturing depth. Each one of these are powerful in itself, but collectively, they are a powerhouse of force.
Well, Jim, we are the only country in the world that has all four of those forces working in our favor. There are countries that have strong manufacturing capacity. There are innovative countries. There are raw material producing countries, energy producing countries. But only the United States has those four forces of creativity, capital, manufacturing depth, and energy working all at once. Now, that's a real differentiator, and that doesn't even include the fact that we also produce agricultural goods, we produce products across the board. Now, one thing that's interesting is that people say so frequently, oh, we don't manufacture things here anymore. You hear that all the time at cocktail parties, in bar discussions, wherever you go, you hear people saying, we don't make things here anymore. But it's absolutely untrue. The United States is still the world's largest manufacturing country. We make more than anyone else. And China has caught up in some years, but we are pulling ahead again. So there's a lot of misinformation about what's going on. Now, what's true is that most of the things that we make, consumers themselves don't buy. I mean, they don't buy radar equipment. They don't buy jet engines. They don't buy jet aircraft. They buy other types of products. And we are very big in the massive manufacturing area of creating the infrastructure for the future. And that only means that going forward, our industries will get stronger.
Joel, why do you believe the doomsday industry is so popular today? You see it at the bookstore, newsletter writers, films. You see it reflected in the markets. I mean, we know that individual investors have poured most of their money since 2009 into the bond market. But the Wall Street Journal did an article last week saying that even institutions, from pension funds to endowment funds to hedge funds, have missed a lot of the rise in the markets because of this sort of doomsday dollar collapse, the economy is going to crash. Why do you think there's so much of that today?
I think there are a number of reasons why, and it's endemic. By the way, you mentioned the Wall Street Journal. Today, There was an article in the Wall Street Journal about the crisis in economics in the United States. And that article came out on the same day that it was announced that the United States produced 286,000 new private sector jobs. So obviously the right hand is not paying attention to what the left hand is doing. All the Wall Street Journal had to do is read some of its other coverage of the economy to see that its article on how the economy is not working was incorrect. But, you know, the mood in Washington has been so toxic that it has really clouded the way people look at the United States. That's clouded the way that the debate has been going, and it's made people despondent. I mean, when you look at how little support there is for Congress, how little respect, to be honest, for government in general, you see that we're in a very toxic environment. And I think that that has really made it difficult for people to see the reality that's going on. But it's not just happening in the United States, by the way, in terms of this toxic outlook of our fortunes. I gave a talk to a group in France. They were saying, oh, all we think about when we think about the United States is debt. And yes, we have a lot of debt, but the truth is it's manageable. It's about the same as it was in the 1950s. We're going to grow out of it, and it's already shrinking. It's not getting bigger. So we are kind of blinded by that toxic discussion, and we're blinded by a lot of illusions about debt. And I think those two factors are important. And there's one other factor that's going on, and that is that for the first time in a long time, both political parties have a reason for saying the future is not bright. On the one hand, the Democrats have a lot of social bills that they want to get passed, that if they were talking about these bills, whether it's Obamacare or others, and saying that the economy is growing, people would not want to raise the minimum wage or other factors. The Republicans, of course, have an incentive to say things are getting worse because they want to regain power in the Senate and they want to take the White House. So both parties have an incentive for talking negatively about the future, and that's really unusual.
In your first chapter in your book, you talk about America's innovation corridor from Boston to Austin to Silicon Valley. Now, obviously, myself living in California and many of our listeners are familiar with Silicon Valley and the tech revolution that we've experienced over the decades. But you talk about this symbiosis between our top universities and business. You know, Joe, I had no idea of the concentration of research and innovation as you describe in that 5-mile area just in Boston alone. Take us through some of that because I found it fascinating.
Well, it is a fascinating trip just to walk through Cambridge, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston, where you have MIT and you have Harvard and other schools. One block after another, you come across essentially the revolution in biotech that is taking place, whether it's the fact that Genzyme is in that area or the Whitehead Institute or the Broad Institute for Research. This is really where the new research on the brain and how it works is taking place at the McGovern Brain Institute. It's where engineering comes together with biotech at MIT's Media Lab. So we, in just this small area of Cambridge, have essentially the center of the biotech world taking place. The world has moved from Switzerland, from France, research capabilities into Cambridge. So Novartis, one of the world's largest pharmaceutical companies, moved essentially all of its researchers out of Switzerland into Cambridge to take advantage of the atmosphere and to take advantage of all the brilliance that is going on in that small part of the world. But what's different about the United States is any country in the world would love to have Cambridge or the equivalent in its borders. But we have more than just Cambridge. We have San Diego. We have Stanford and San Francisco, that area of the country. We have Austin. We have Research Triangle. We have the I-95 corridor. We have Minneapolis and Seattle. We have some tremendous resources in terms of research that don't exist anywhere in the world. Now, what's interesting is that China has invested an enormous amount of money to create a biotech center in Shanghai. But so far, it hasn't yielded anything except some very technical work that is not really productive and has not in any way advanced our thinking and advanced innovation. So we have a particular kind of culture in the United States that is very different and is very, very powerful with regard to the kinds of innovation and the practicality of our innovations and our ability to mix academic research at the very, very highest levels with research in the factory or in the pharmaceutical company. So we blend all of that together in a way that's not possible in other countries.
You know, something that is unique about the United States, I wonder if you might comment, no other country, Joel, possesses, I think it's really a unique American advantage, and that's that pragmatic entrepreneurial culture that we have. We have such an individualistic culture. For example, during the downturn, during the financial crisis, many people that maybe lost work or couldn't find jobs out of college go out and start these companies that become highly successful. You just don't find that. And I want to get to the impact of foreigners on that. You just don't find that in other countries.
No, you don't. Europe, for example, has been trying to stimulate entrepreneurship for 25 or 30 years, and it's failed to do so. It can't get people to take risks. One of the problems in Europe has been that their culture, if you fail starting a company in Europe, you're regarded as someone who can't succeed, who's a failure. You're marked for life, and no one wants to take that risk of ending their careers. In the United States, if you fail, people say, well, at least you learned what not to do, and we take it in stride. You know, that's a huge advantage, to be able to slough off failure and move forward no matter what, is something that we alone have. Now, there are some other creative parts of the world, and there are smart people in every country. And the reason why we know they're smart in other countries is because when they come here, they really flourish. We see that in Silicon Valley. We see that in startups. 30% of Silicon Valley startups were begun by foreign workers who came to the United States as immigrants, either to go to school or to work here, fell in love with the atmosphere of creativity and started companies. And we are very, very lucky to have these people who come here. But in their own countries, if you have Indian entrepreneurs in the United States, in their own country, they will not, because the climate is so different, they will not start companies. The United States has unique attributes in that respect.
I want to talk about something that you illustrate here in your stroll through the innovation corridor. And that is, you know, you take one well-known college, MIT, and just what they've done in the biomedical industry. You talk about the U.S. Department of Labor added up the impact of this research-intensive sector of the economy and found that it directly accounted for 1.2 million private sector jobs in 2009, $96 billion in wages, and $213 billion in output. And I think, Joe, you also talk about a statistic of the number of graduates from MIT, the companies they started with gross sales. I think the figure was in the trillions.
Yeah, you know, it's incredible. And MIT in particular is responsible for the creation of 25,000 companies. That's a staggering number when you think about a single university in the United States responsible for creating that many companies. And that, of course, goes back 100 years or so, but it's a very impressive statistic. By the way, in Unleashing the Second American Century, that I really focus on, and that is we think about education all wrong. We think about it typically as a cost, and we say, my, you know, supporting colleges and universities are so expensive. The budgets are rising. The inflation in salaries in these universities is staggering. You know, these are not good deals. But the fact is, we need to start thinking of these universities as investments, because when you consider the return on rather small government funding of a school like MIT, you see that we're talking about, as you say, trillions of dollars in revenue, millions of jobs created, thousands and thousands of companies. And this isn't slowing down, by the way. This is far from over. We continue to see 40 or 50 biotech companies started a year, every year out of MIT. We see other types of high-tech companies in computing, manufacturing, started from MIT. And MIT, again, is just one school within the country. Carnegie Mellon has given birth to lots of computer companies. Stanford, we know, has given birth to Google, many computing companies, Apple, and so forth, all come out of that area around Stanford. Berkeley is another school where we have tremendous, tremendous growth as a result of it. And by the way, Jim, this did not happen by accident. This was planned after World War II, when our government had the foresight to recognize that science and technology, engineering and math would be the future of the United States economy, and we invested in those capacities, and it's been paying off for 75 years and will continue to pay off as long as we continue to invest. So this is not a random event. The United States has achieved this greatness in science because it was seen as important for the future, and we have pursued it with tremendous energy as a result.
You contend in the book, you know, when you add up all these forces, and as we've been talking here, instead of decline, the American economy, thanks to our treasured innovators, is increasing its dominance. We're seeing that with the amount of money we spend in R&D. But let's go to something that maybe has darkened many people's feelings, and this has led to the doomsday prepper crowd, and that's about the financial crisis this country experienced between 2007 and 2009. Now, some have called it the Great Recession. Joel, you call it a rich man's depression. Explain your reasoning behind that, which is a different perspective than the numerous gloom and doom books which are popular today.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jim, because I do think that period is different. I believe that from 2007, 2008 to about 2010, we were actually in a depression. The difference between the depression, I call it a rich man's depression, the difference between that one and what we experienced in the 30s is that we were 20 or so times richer when we experienced that depression. And as a result, we fell, but we were so much richer that when we did fall, we had quite a cushion. And so, although many, many people were hurt, a lot fewer people were destitute than during the 1930s when the whole world caved in. And that's because of our wealth. So depressions do terrible things to economies, but they also do some good things to economies, ultimately. It's a very painful medicine, but it's medicine nonetheless. And what they do is they move debt from individuals onto the government. That's how you fix a depression, and you do it by you take individual personal debt, you move it onto the government's balance sheet. The government has ways to pay off that debt, and suddenly people are rejuvenated in terms of their spending power. Now, we saw that happening because the fall was so big in 2007. It's taken a long time to get our footing again, but I believe we have it now, and the rich man's depression had quite a cleansing effect. Now, I said that during this rich man's depression, we ended up essentially doing away with a huge amount of consumer debt. So consumers in the United States are in the best shape they've been in 35 years. They have tremendous spending power. It's come back. They're being very prudent. They're saving more. So that's an effect of having gone through this terrible crisis. And also the amount of growth that spending power will produce is now back to levels we haven't seen since the 1970s. So I think we're in the position where we are starting to see all of the factors put in place for big growth as a result of having cleaned out the system.
Let's talk about something in an agency or an organization within the government that a lot of our listeners may not be aware of, but the role it plays in American innovation. Let's talk about DARPA, an organization I've heard of it before, but a lot of people haven't, and it's only because I've come across it in a lot of my research. But DARPA, talk about what it does and its influence, and more importantly, how that reflects American creativity at the highest level, and how it's run and how it measures success, which if you look at the way they measure success, would not be the way most people think of it.
Jim, I'm glad that you raised that issue because DARPA does not get the kind of attention it should get. You know, DARPA was set up, it stands for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. That's why we call it DARPA, because it's such a boring government name, but it's anything but boring. When Sputnik was launched by the Soviet Union in 1957, President Eisenhower said, "We were surprised, we were caught off guard, we had no idea that the Russians were that much farther ahead with regard to space than we are, and we need to do something about it." So the reason for setting up DARPA was so that the United States would never be surprised by the developments going on in another country. In other words, we would never be eclipsed as we were in 1957 by the launch of Sputnik. Over the years, a culture has developed at DARPA of outright creativity, crazy creativity, practical creativity, and it has produced enormous advances for the country. For example, the Saturn rockets that put men on the moon in the 1960s were developed by DARPA. People don't usually know that. The GPS system that we use that has created enormous wealth, by the way, by helping airliners fly more safely and more efficiently between points, that was developed by DARPA. DARPA also has developed new types of radar, robotics, medical devices, and so forth, so that the United States will never be eclipsed by another country. In robotics, it's quite amazing what DARPA has done. I mean, we all know about some of the work where we excel in robotics, but some of the inventions are artificial limbs for servicemen, in particular service personnel who have been wounded. These artificial limbs, in some cases now, are controlled by the brain of the wounded warriors. This is a tremendous advance to be able to control a machine directly with your brain. And that kind of research is not owned by DARPA. It's allowed to be dispensed with throughout the economy. So all of DARPA's inventions benefit the entire economy. That's why we were the country to benefit most from the GPS system so quickly. We allowed it to flow through the economy. Among the other types of things that DARPA has developed are new types of wound treatments, primarily, again, for soldiers. But some of these new type of wound dressings that instantly stop bleeding, internal bleeding, hemorrhaging, and so forth, are also tremendous medical advances that have been developed by DARPA. Now, what's interesting about DARPA is that no one is allowed to work at DARPA for longer than 4 years. That's the maximum term that you can have. So they constantly have a turnover of some of the brightest people in the country. They reach out, they select people to be researchers at DARPA, and they know that they have a 4-year maximum term limit. Second, DARPA really does very little research on its own. What it does is it hires consulting firms, engineering companies, colleges and universities to do the research. It tells them what it wants in terms of a product, but it allows the researchers to pursue the most creative approach they can. And finally, the measure of success at DARPA is not the number of products that work, it's the number that don't work. because what the director of research at DARPA told me is that if he has too high a success rate, it means he's not taking big enough risks. And the role of DARPA is to take the biggest risks possible to get the biggest benefit so the United States is never surprised again by the developments of another country.
One interesting thing that I'd like you to explain, and this really, I think, exemplifies why the U.S. is so innovative, and that's the problem of Boyden's case, his project on brain seizures. He took an engineer who he wanted to hire in his research project for delivering a mechanism to solve it. This guy was designing automatic ski racks for cars. You would
right.
not see, Joel, you know, you wouldn't see that in Europe. You would have to have a pedigree, PhD from some poly institute or something like that. But, you know, some guy that's designing ski racks for cars, it just wouldn't happen.
No, it wouldn't happen, you know, and Ed Boyden has won almost every prize available for young scientists by the time he was 30. He's a brilliant, brilliant researcher at MIT. He developed a way to stop seizures. Now, it's very early in his research, and it could fail, but at this point, at least in mice, this approach, which uses virus that carry specific types of cells into the brains of mice that are capable of turning off an epileptic seizure, this was all forefront research that he devised. Now, in order to build out his team, he hired an engineer who had, as you say, invented ski racks that would automatically put the skis onto the top of your car. It had a particular type of mechanical parts and so forth, but he had no background in biotech, certainly no background in brain research, and yet he was hired onto the team because he had certain expertise that Dr. Boyden thought would work on his team. Now, that's unheard of in Europe. Just like the head of the MIT Media Lab, which is doing really forefront research, especially with regard to the brain, the MIT Media Lab is headed now not by a scientist and not even by someone with a PhD. In fact, the head of the MIT Research, the Media Lab, is headed by someone who never graduated college. He started college. He dropped out. He worked to invest in and develop software for the internet. He made money doing it. He was at the forefront, involved with innovators all over the world. And he was hired as an out-of-the-box thinking type of hire to run the MIT Media Lab. Now, in Europe, as you say, Jim, that kind of prestigious appointment would only go to someone with many, many years of experience in a very similar type of laboratory setting with all the right credentials, the PhDs and so forth. But at MIT, they said, you know, we need someone who is more creative and who sees the future better than any person around. Therefore, we're going to throw open all of the credentials, we're going to open the box, and we're going to just go and try and find the smartest, most innovative person around, and we don't care what his or her background is. And they found someone of tremendous ability. So far, it looks like it's working really well, and it's a completely out-of-the-box hire. That would never happen in another country. So we have the ability to integrate, to assimilate people of diverse ways of thinking, of diverse backgrounds, to build teams with them, and to create leading innovative organizations as a result. And I think MIT exemplifies that very well. And in fact, MIT has had that category. They call it instructor, which is essentially not a professor. It's someone with a different background who they have hired to develop new areas of research. And they've had that category for 100 years. That's unheard of in other countries.
Joe, I want to move on to one of your forces, and that is energy. In 2005, conventional oil peaked in this country in May of that year. That's the kind of you poke a hole in the ground and the oil gushes out. But in 2008, Over 50% of our trade deficit consisted of oil imports. Last year, according to the BP statistical review, 96% of oil production gains in OECD countries was accounted for by the U.S. I don't think people realize how big that is.
You know, when you consider how much oil we consume, we are the largest consumer of oil. So if you consider any increase, 1%, 2%, 5% in our production, that's tremendous in terms of global capacity. But we have gone from essentially importing more than 60% of our oil. In December of 2013, we imported only 32%. So we have seen a 50% decline in the amount of oil we have imported. And the reason for that is that, you know, we've had entrepreneurs in this country who were willing to risk it all to develop fracking technology. Some of them did not make it. They went out of business. They tried to develop this new technology. Others succeeded, and in particular, George Mitchell, a wildcatter in Houston, Texas, invested $20 million of his own money in research into making this technology work, and he succeeded. As a result, this one guy, at the time he was in his late 80s, believe it or not, and George Mitchell created a revolution. And that revolution has turned North Dakota, parts of Texas and Pennsylvania, there are parts of California that are in line as well. It has turned these areas of the country into some of the largest energy producing areas of the world. North Dakota has gone from essentially producing almost no energy at all a decade ago to being the second largest energy producer in the country after Texas. There's a huge growth in jobs, and the technology is fracking technology, which people think, you know, when they talk about it, they think it's probably dangerous. They don't understand it. But in fact, it's quite a safe technology now that it's been perfected. And like all technologies that are new, there are teething problems, but it seems like we've worked them out. And this has created a boom that has turn the United States at this point into the world's largest energy producing country. So this could not have come at a better time, number one. But number two, this kind of turnaround never happens. There is no other example in the world of a country that has gone from first in terms of energy production, as we were in the 1950s, to importing more energy than any other country in the world. And then turning around to again become the world's largest energy producer, an oil exporting and natural gas exporting country as well. And we are in line to be reducing our trade deficit as a result very significantly. And as we do it, money will be flowing back into our shores. So it's estimated that more than 1 million jobs will be created from fracking in the next decade as pipelines are being built, new wells are being drilled, depots are being built in order to store energy, and ultimately as big export facilities are being built. So these are high-paying jobs. We're talking about welders. We're talking about construction jobs at a very high level, in some cases $100,000 a year. For welding jobs and these very specific high-tech types of welding, this is a tremendous transformation. Now, in my book, I have a list of 3 pages of new companies, new big investments, $85 billion of new investments in manufacturing capacity as a result of energy. So we're talking, yes, about chemicals, of course. Chemical can use natural gas or oil as feedstock. The United States chemical industry is growing like mad. BASF, the largest chemical company in the world, the German company, said the center of the chemical industry is now moving to the United States. So we're seeing big changes in that respect. But we're also starting to see, because natural gas is so cheap in the United States, we're also starting to see trucking companies switching to natural gas. We're starting to see factories switching to natural gas. And the added benefit is natural gas is very clean compared to coal, and it's cleaner than oil as well. So we are the only country that has also reduced its emissions of CO2 over the last decade as a result of switching to natural gas. So we are really benefiting from this one man's successful entrepreneurial venture, George Mitchell, and it shows you the power of taking risks and creating a climate where you can take risks. And Jim, there's one factor in the United States that makes this possible that other countries do not have, and that is that in the United States, an individual is allowed to own what's underneath the ground. In almost every other country, what's underneath the ground is owned by the government. So if I'm an oil entrepreneur, you know, there's no reason I should prospect in Saudi Arabia or Mexico or even in France or Italy because I can't own what I find. The government owns it. But in the United States, there's this huge incentive that if I dig a hole in the ground and strike oil, that's my oil if I obtain the rights to that piece of ground. That's a difference that we have, and that is why half of the wells in the world have been drilled in the United States.
Joe, I want to move on to two other forces and cover them because we're running out of time here, but let's talk about something that's not widely understood, which is the access to capital. We had mentioned this earlier in our conversation, but when you have it, it becomes a powerful economic force. I mean, when you talk about the trillions of dollars that are traded in the bond markets, the trillions in the currency market, when there's a crisis and that money is seeking a safe home or a haven, the United States is a magnet for that capital, and that gives us another advantage. And also, along those lines, let's weave into that story the trillions of dollars of cash, unfortunately, sitting on American corporations' balance sheets that is begging for the opportunity to come back and reinvest, but doesn't because we have the highest tax rates in the world.
Jim, you mentioned a big issue, and that is that our corporate tax rates really are out of whack with the rest of the world. And what we're finding is that they have increased to the point where they are much higher than most countries. Canada, Britain, even places like Russia have very, very low corporate tax compared to the United States. And even worse, if you make money from your company overseas and you bring it back, you're paying tax in two places. You're paying it here in the United States, and you're paying it where you earned it. So we have to remedy that. And that's one reason why American companies are sitting on tremendous amounts of capital overseas. No one knows exactly how much, but the estimate is roughly $5 trillion is just sitting in bank accounts overseas. Now, people may say, oh, you need to have incentives to bring more investment into the United States to create jobs. Well, the biggest incentive you can have in order to create jobs in the United States is to lower the corporate tax rate so that companies will invest here and they'll bring their money from Europe or Asia where they're keeping it back into the United States to build new factories. So that has to be addressed, and that's squarely on the doorstep of Congress, and Congress needs to address that. That's a glaring problem right now that we have to fix.
Let's move on to a force that this is one that we see growing evidence every day. You talk about it in your book where you list, I think, all the companies that are building factories here, is the U.S. manufacturing prowess. And most people don't think of that. As you mentioned, you know, as individuals, we think of consumer products. Our TVs are made in Asia. You know, our iPods, even though it's Apple, is made in China, although some of that is changing. The big stuff, Caterpillar tractor, you know, jet turbines and things like that we make here. Let's talk about manufacturing, because this manufacturing renaissance, and this is something that I've seen, is the labor arbitrage where factories used to, let's say companies would move to Mexico or Asia because of labor differential. The age of robotics is changing and getting rid of that labor arbitrage. And the new factories that are going to be built here obviously are going to be a much different factory. I think of Tesla, you think of Apple's new factory they're building in Phoenix, it's not going to be Larry Moe and Curly on the assembly line putting the bumper on. It's going to be a guy with a white lab coat. He's programming a computer that's operating a $20 million robot.
What we're seeing is that old manufacturing techniques went overseas to Asia and so forth because it was cheaper based on labor. What's coming back is manufacturing that went to college. It's so much smarter. We have robots that are very efficient. You need at least a community college degree in order to know how to do the math to program those robots. But they are coming back and they will be creating jobs. This is real. We're seeing it in terms of tens of billions of dollars being invested in the auto industry in the United States with new factories. And we're seeing it in terms of big companies like GE expanding what was unheard of in the past, manufacturing things like refrigerators and dishwashers and washing machines in the United States again. This is because of advanced robotics. We've always been worried that robots are going to kill jobs, but that's not the case. In fact, I have a Life magazine on my desk from 1963 that warns of automation killing jobs. And in fact, after 1963, we had the largest growth in job creation in our history. So that's not going to happen. What's going to happen is these factories in a myriad of industries will be very successful, and they will be right next to the customer. That's really important because, you know, fads and styles change so quickly that if you manufacture products in China and you send a prototype to China, they manufacture it there, they send the product back, you're talking about a three-month period. But if you're manufacturing that product in Texas or Arizona or in Tennessee, you can make changes and ship it within days. So time has really become a very big factor in choosing where to manufacture. And being close to the market is much more important than the cost of wages. And in addition, the American worker is just the most productive worker in the world. And it's not just because I'm pro-America. That's what the statistics say. American workers produce about $120,000 worth of value per year, and $77,000 per year is the average in Europe. So we are significantly more productive than the rest of the world, and it's not because of anything except that we work a lot smarter here.
Joel, anytime you make a forecast, obviously there are events that are unforeseen that can change a lot of things. But if there is anything that could disrupt your thesis, I guess a final question, how can we as a country lose another American century?
Well, that's a good question, Jim. And what I think, for example, is the deadlock in Washington. That can't stop the growth that's coming, but it can certainly slow it down. It already has. It's created a chilling effect. I mean, think about the absolute stop in Washington last year in terms of what that did to the economy. We felt that for 3 or 4 months in terms of lost GDP. So we can see Washington slowing that down. The other fact is we have to take into account the dangerous world that we live in and recognize that the Middle East and elsewhere, we need to take a leadership position there. We can't really back off from our responsibilities globally and just expect the world to be a nice place to live and everybody get along. This is a dangerous world. It's getting more dangerous in many ways. And, you know, mishaps, particularly nuclear problems, could really end our growth in a big way. So I think the political situation domestically and the geopolitical situation outside the country are very, very big factors. And that is because it's not just the United States we have to worry about. We are essentially providing goods and services to the rest of the world. So we want the rest of the world to succeed and to be successful. The more successful they are, the bigger our markets will be and the better we'll do. And that means we have to take a leadership role in terms of geopolitics. If we don't do that, I think that could be a significant negative.
Yeah, because anytime there's a leadership vacuum, in fact, Denise D'Souza's got a new movie coming out. I think it's going to be in the theater shortly, called America. Imagine the world without America. Well, listen, Joe, we run out of time, and I want to thank you for being so generous of yours.
Well, thanks, Jim. I really enjoyed it.
The name of the book is called Unleashing the Second American Century, Four Forces for Economic Dominance by Joel Kurtzman, who's been my guest. Joel, thanks so much for being generous with your time. A fabulous book, and recommend if you are predisposed towards the negative, maybe a dollar crash, the end of America as we know it, I'd advise you to pick up Joel's book. It'll give you a different perspective.
Well, today's program has wrapped out what we've done here. 2 weeks of Jim Poplava going on the record, answering emails that have come into us over the year by themes. As a matter of fact, we generally read a lot of emails and then combine them together. Next week, Jim, we start another year of live programming. And typically, traditionally, we do a projection of what we think's coming for 2015. So we'll see whether or not there are a lot of changes between 2014 and 2015.
Yeah, it's amazing. You ought to see my stack of reading to do during the Christmas holidays. John, it's probably the biggest stack I've had in a couple of years. And it's funny, too, because as we were doing this, and as I read a lot of research reports, and, you know, I also do a couple things during the holidays. I go to the bookstore. I grab everything I can get on the rack in terms of 2015. I don't care if it's Money Magazine, Kiplinger Magazine, Forbes, Fortune, you name it. I read all that because I want to see what the public's reading, what the investment public, and then I guess I get more in-depth material that I read personally from the research reports that we get. And it's funny because this year has been probably one of the more difficult years for a lot of these investment houses, research firms that are doing forecasting for the year ahead. One firm had to change their forecast 3 times because they start putting together their forecast in October. Well, what happened between October and December? The price of oil fell like $30 a barrel. And so that was impacting a lot of the forecasts that a lot of these firms were trying to make. In fact, all of them, in some of the ones I've started to read, they've put some caveats there and they go, as we go to press, this is the price of oil. You know, our assumptions based on this report are based on oil prices at this, and then we predict that, you know, economic growth will be this. But if oil prices go down further or they go up, this forecast may be outdated. In fact, one firm said, you know what? We're only going to forecast out to the first quarter because things are changing so rapidly in the oil markets and the commodity markets that we don't want to go beyond that and predict anything because the things can change so rapidly, we don't want to put something out there. So it's going to be interesting because I think next year is going to be more volatile because we will have at some point, whether it's the end of Q3, Q4, whenever the Fed goes, we're going to have interest rates that they'll start to raise interest rates. That'll be initial shock. A couple other things that are themes going into the beginning of the year. We do know that oil inventories are continuing to build. Economic growth is weak. Our American oil companies are still producing, but we are starting to see cutbacks, cutbacks on the number of drills, rigs that are out there. We're seeing companies cut back on expenditures. Some companies like BP are actually going through restructuring, laying off employees. So Western oil companies are adjusting to the price of oil. And we know sooner or later there's a balance that's going to come to the market probably by the time we get into the second quarter. So that's going to change a lot of these forecasts that are being made right now. And I think next year is going to be a little bit more challenging, but on the surface, I still think it's going to be a good year. But John, if there's anything, as I look at this stuff, of course, I've got a lot more to read yet, it'll probably be a good year, less than this year. I would be really surprised to see if we get a double-digit year in the market again. And I think, if anything, more volatile and more bumps. But that's just getting ahead of ourselves. I've got a lot more material to digest. It'll be interesting to see what these reports are, because the ones I'm reading right now, a lot of these people have come out, the strategists have come out and said, this is really a difficult one to call because it's just changing by the minute. And folks, just think of what you've seen at the gas pump here over probably, what, the last 6 weeks at the price of oil. When you think about it, from what, June, July, the price of oil has come down $50 a barrel. The price of gasoline has come down over $1 a gallon. That is significant. That has a major impact on consumer pocketbooks. The production cost of manufacturing materials or shipping goods. So it's going to be an interesting year, John. Who knows how it'll play out? But we'll be here once again with our regular show and our forecast show at the beginning of the year. In the meantime, as you're listening to this program, we hope that you find yourself happy, prosperous, and that you've had a safe new year. Until we talk again, have yourself a pleasant weekend.
Now's the time for us to say Happy New Year!
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the shows. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.